intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And we'll begin today with a story from the May 26th edition, A Fine Country for Old Men. This is written by Idris Kowloon. Gerontocracy has always thrived in undemocratic places, communist people's republics, Gulf monarchies, where only death could pry power from ruling elders. American gerontocracy is exceptional for being freely elected. Donald Trump will soon be an octogenarian and is president in part because the preceding octogenarian, Joe Biden, did not want to admit his senescence. The median senator is 65, and the oldest, 92-year-old Chuck Grassley, has not ruled out running for re-election in 2028. The typical general election voter is a spry 52, but in primary elections, which decide the majority of political contests, that number rises to 59. Half of all the money donated to political campaigns comes from Americans age 66 or older. Although political gerontocracy has operated overtly, the rising economic power of the elderly has escaped much notice. Over the past 40 or so years, American wealth has grown ever more concentrated among the oldest generations. In 1989, Americans over age 55 held 56% of it. Today, they hold 74%. During that same period, the share of wealth held by Americans under 40 has shrunk by nearly half, from 12 to 6.6%. The color of money is now gray. Much of this shift is the result of demographic change. 18% of Americans are senior citizens today, up from 13% in 1990. But even at the household level, Americans over 55 have accrued wealth more rapidly than those who are younger. Among those 75 and older, the numbers are particularly striking. In 1983, their household net worth was only slightly above the national average. By 2022, it was 55% higher. For nearly a century, some of the central debates in American politics have been over inequalities between rich and poor, male and female, black and white. When the baby boomers were children, older Americans were widely viewed as vulnerable. 50% of the elderly exist below minimum standards of decency, and this is a figure much higher than that for any other age group. Michael Harrington wrote in his 1962 book, The Other America, often credited with inspiring the war on poverty. This is no country for old men. 3 years later, in 1965, Medicare was created. A major expansion of Social Security followed in 1972. These changes were remarkably effective. The share of elderly people living in poverty dropped by more than one-third within a decade. But because these programs are broad-based entitlements, they have transferred huge sums to the prosperous, too. The portfolios of that latter group, meanwhile, have been swelled by a rising stock market and rising home values, outcomes that may not be entirely replicable for younger generations. As a result of all these factors, intergenerational inequality between old and young has not merely reversed. It has accelerated. Most current Social Security and Medicare beneficiaries will receive more from the program over their lifetime than they paid in taxes, and the extra money will necessarily come from the pockets of younger generations. The two programs now pay out more than $2 trillion a year, more than one-third of all federal expenditures. Their Sustainability was a subject of major debate during the Obama years, when the national debt was much lower than it is today, and interest rates on that debt were close to zero. Financially, the matter is more urgent now. The trust funds for Social Security benefits and Medicare's hospital insurance are projected to become insolvent in roughly 7 years. Yet even noticing the looming threats has become taboo for the two major political parties. One of Trump's shrewdest political realizations was that entitlement reform, once a priority for fiscal conservatives, was a losing issue. Instead, he has pledged not to touch entitlement spending and lavish seniors with even more government money. His One Big Beautiful Bill Act created a special $6,000 tax deduction for seniors, which will cost taxpayers $91 billion over the next 4 years. The same bill cuts $1 trillion in spending on Medicaid, which is expected to leave some 5 million working-age Americans uninsured. This bodes poorly for intergenerational peace. Respect for elders is being replaced by resentment of elders. A majority of young Americans no longer believe in the American dream. Many millennials and Gen Zers expressly blame the boomers for that, accusing them of hoarding wealth, jobs, and power. Many of these accusations are inchoate, but they are not entirely baseless. The best rebuttal to the gerontocratic critique is that young Americans do not appreciate how good they have it. Although people of working age possess a smaller share of the national wealth, they are richer in absolute terms than boomers were at their age. The median 35-year-old millennial earns 38% more in post-tax, inflation-adjusted income than the typical boomer did at the same age, according to research by the economist Kevin Cornith. Gen Zers have only begun their careers, but so far they are earning more than their millennial predecessors. This trend shows up in wealth statistics, too. When boomers were between the ages of 25 and 43, they had a median net worth of $58,000 in 2022. Millennials at the same age of life had a net worth of $85,000. So why are young people so depressed about their economic future? The pathologies of the housing market are one reason. A typical home today costs 5 times the median annual income, up from 3.5 times the median annual income in 1984. Boomers got lucky. When they were young, they could afford to buy houses that then appreciated fantastically in value. But that luck was arguably manufactured by Washington, which engineered the rise of 30-year fixed-rate mortgages and created tax deductions for mortgage interest and property taxes. These government subsidies still exist today, but even with them, younger Americans cannot buy houses at the same rate that boomers did. In a paper titled, quote, Giving Up, end quote, the economist Sung Hyung Lee and Young Jung Yu predicted that millennials will enter retirement with much lower homeownership rates than the generations before them, 74% compared with 84% for boomers. Some 15% of millennials, they noted, had already given up on homeownership by age 30. These millennials, they found, work less, spend more on credit, and are more likely to buy cryptocurrency or make other risky investments. Feeling locked out of owning a house casts a malaise, one made worse by the anxiety that the welfare state they currently support will become stingier when they eventually need it. Older generations use the levers of government to create this situation. In high-cost cities, the building of new homes and apartment complexes is often derailed in local planning and zoning board meetings. In 2019, the political scientists Catherine Levine Einstein, Maxwell Palmer, and David Glick published a study examining who attended such meetings in the Boston area. The attendees they found were likely to be longtime homeowners who oppose new development. Preventing construction kept the value of their assets high, at the expense of younger prospective homeowners. Homeowner preferences, hard-coded into state constitutions decades ago, now further sustain the gerontocracy. In 1978, Californians voted by referendum for Proposition 13, which severely limited the property taxes that existing homeowners would have to pay, so long as they remained in place. In one study, the law was estimated to have caused a 15% increase in California housing prices all by itself. As longtime homeowners profited, the lost tax revenue forced reductions in school spending. California is not unique, and housing is not the only means by which the older generations have effectively pulled up the ladder behind them. Preferences for the elderly over the young are a fixture of public budgets nationwide. Across all government programs, federal, state, and local, $2 are now spent on seniors for every $1 spent on children. According to Tim Vlandis, an Oxford political economist, advanced democracies around the world are reaching the point of gerontonomia, his term for a stagnating political economy set up to prioritize elderly citizens. These citizens punish their elected governments for inflation, which lessens the value of savings and pension payments. They are much more tolerant of unemployment because they no longer work. Slow growth because their wealth has already accumulated, and high public debt because their descendants will pay it. The result, Landis argues, is lower wage growth for those still working, and also worse outcomes for their children, as a result of lower social investment over the course of their lives. Graying democracies everywhere have made generous pension commitments that are struggling to maintain. In the United Kingdom, the triple lock, a rule that most years mandates that state pensions increase more than inflation, seems politically impossible to change. In France, people protested for months against Emmanuel Macron in 2023 over the raising of the retirement age from 62 to 64. Yet these challenges are especially acute in America. Because Social Security still has a trust fund to draw on, voters may not realize that benefits have already exceeded contributions. But this fund, which stood at $2.9 trillion in 2021, is on pace to dwindle to zero by about 2033. The Trump administration's immigration crackdown will hasten the arrival of Exhaustion Day by cutting the number of taxpaying workers who support retirees' benefits. Once that trust fund is gone, absent a tax increase on current workers or some other change, beneficiaries would suffer an immediate 23% cut in payments. A similar process would leave the Medicare Part A program, which covers hospital stays for the elderly, insolvent at about the same time. The national debt will by then be gargantuan. Previously unthinkable ideas, such as means-tested Social Security benefits, confiscatory wealth taxes, and even health care rationing, might be contemplated. The bill coming due for the senior welfare state might not trouble this president, but it could well be the defining problem for the next one. Some people would like to start the fight over how to resolve it now. Among them are radical thinkers who contend that in order to defeat economic gerontocracy, Americans must first defang the elderly ruling class. In his forthcoming book, Gerontocracy in America, the 54-year-old Yale law and history professor Samuel Moyne calls for destroying this tyranny of the minority set up by old people with enormous private power who hold society in chains. Power, he argues, needs to be seized back, heaving the elderly divested leaving the elderly divested of political power, wealth, and property. Moyne wants to create mandatory retirement ages, perhaps starting as low as 65, for elected officials and people with some desirable private sector jobs. Then he would come for the money, increasing taxes on both income and accumulated assets to dilute the share of elderly wealth. Most astonishingly, he proposes diluting older Americans' political power, too, by literally valuing the votes of younger people more, on the theory that the latter will suffer the consequences of political decisions for much longer. This proposed social engineering is both harsh and vanishingly improbable. The modern legal principle of one person, one vote exists for good reason. Still, Moyne's ideas underscore the need for an equitable post-boomer settlement, one that will be easier to find if we start the search sooner rather than later. In the 20th century, the United States realized it was too rich and too decent a country to allow its elderly citizens to live in penury, and it made an enduring commitment to address that problem, one that has unequivocally succeeded. There has never been a better time to be a senior citizen in America. And yet the U.S. has made no comparable commitment to working families, who are stymied not only by expensive housing, but also by child care and higher education bills. Child poverty in America persists at levels alarmingly higher than in other advanced democracies. Initiatives such as Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal and Lyndon B. Johnson's Great Society established what current workers in a decent country owed to retirees. A new social contract can be struck that would deliver at least some optimism for today's workers. Curing gerontonomia would require redirecting some public funds from programs aimed at the elderly, such as Social Security, to family benefits, education, and infrastructure. But an intergenerational recalibration can come about in gentler ways than Moyne's. The wealthiest Social Security recipients, for instance, could forego some of their scheduled benefits, which could instead be contributed annually to a baby bond account for America's children, a source of capital to be used in adulthood. And not every solution rests with the welfare state. Cutting through housing restrictions would generate enormous social benefit if America's elderly ruling class were to allow such a feat. Today's gerontocrats will eventually die, but their legacy will be a mess to sort out. Our next story, The Guitar Sounds New Again. This is written by Nancy Walecki. Every now and then, music gets a guitar hero, a player who makes the instrument sound like something other than itself. Jeff Beck transformed it into something like the human voice singing. Jimi Hendrix, a psychedelic swirl. Fans are always looking for the next player who will make the same six-string instrument sound new again. And now, Mick G, that's MK.GEE, has hit the scene. A 29-year-old from New Jersey, whose real name is Michael Gordon, Mick G released his debut album, Two Star and the Dream Police, in 2024. On it, his guitar sounds at various points like an orchestra, a snarling animal, a wildfire, a person shouting, and a radio playing at the bottom of the ocean. Critics declared Mick G a guitar hero. He played on a Bon Iver album and worked on two Justin Bieber records. This past weekend he performed with Bieber at Coachella. Listen long enough and you'll realize that Mick G's grungy extraterrestrial sound is everywhere. The quest to achieve the Mick G tone spawned a series of "How does he make his guitar sound like that?" YouTube videos. Musicians compared notes on Discord servers and Reddit threads. They also did what they've always done, gone to concerts and looked at the stage floor to see what gear the other guys got. And Eventually, some posted a photo of Mick G's stage setup. There on the ground, surrounded by cables, was a large black box adorned with knobs and sliders, and, in a cheesy futuristic font, straight out of a 90s bowling alley, the name, VG8. That Reddit post was probably the most fame the Roland VG8, short for virtual guitar, had gotten since the 1990s. Released in 1995, the VG8 was designed to be a toolbox filled with essentially every existing guitar sound. Chris Bristol, the former chair and CEO of Roland USA, told me, "Players could make their guitar sound like a different model and electronically switch amplifiers, microphones, and even the acoustic environment. Push some buttons, and the guitar might sound like an Eric Clapton-style Fender Stratocaster played in a small club. Push some others, and get a Jimi Hendrix-esque fuzz distortion in a stadium." The VG8 also comes with dozens of synthy sounds and guitar effects, which, if Reddit and my ears are correct, are a big part of Mick G's tone. They were for Joni Mitchell's, too. My father, Fred Walecki, owned a musical instrument shop, Westwood Music, where Mitchell was a customer, and he procured a VG8 for her in 1995 when she told him that she was going to quit music. Her songbook uses more than 50 tunings, and she was tired of constantly retuning dozens of guitars on tour. Dad got her a VG8 because with it, she could keep her guitar in standard tuning and let the device produce her more unusual ones. Because of the device, she kept touring, and the sounds of the VG8 itself brought to her music a freshness and distinctiveness that's almost orchestral. It's so rich, she told a Billboard reporter at the time. I wanted to blow chords up in size the way Georgia O'Keeffe blew up the flowers in her paintings, and now that's possible. Other musicians followed. Reeves Gabrials used the VG8 extensively in his work with David Bowie. Sting wrote most of his 1998 album Brand New Day on it. He told Revolver magazine that the device gave me a shot in the arm about being creative on guitar. But the VG8 retailed for about $3,000, and because of the price, it was very elitist, expensive technological product. Paul Youngblood, the former president of Roland's USA Boss Division, who helped develop the VG8, told me. It also came with a 118-page document, closer to a textbook than a user manual. A few influential musicians loved it for a while. Then, for about 30 years, VG8s collected dust. Now they're making a comeback. VG8s were selling only occasionally, and for $200 or so, before Mick G released Two Star and the Dream Police. According to data provided to me by the Music Gear marketplace, Reverb, in the months following his debut, demand for the VG8 rose, and so did its prices, reaching $1,200 in early 2025. Kevin Muro, a musician who performs under the name Kevum, has seen them for $2,000 and sometimes $3,000. Accounting for inflation, that's still roughly half the price it was in 1995. The competition for VG8s is steep enough that Muro set up alerts on his phone for new listings. "Pray for me, y'all," he wrote on the VG8 channel of a Mick G Discord server. A caption on a Mick G fan Instagram account reads, "Men want one thing, and it's a VG8. The VG8's appeal is as much about what it can't do as what it can. Music technology in 1995 wasn't anywhere near what it is today, Youngblood said. Play too hard or too loud, and the VG8 will spit out something choppy and explosive. Even though the device was advanced for the time, it still had a lo-fi kind of sound to it. The noise that the VG8 makes, simply because it's old, has become a genre in itself, thanks to Mick G. The guitar track on Lord's 2025 Shapeshifter sounds more like a gritty string quartet than it does a guitar. That's Mick G's touring band member, Andrew Aged, on the VG8. Mick G declined to comment for this article. Mick G himself plays a Fender Jaguar, which had a similar resurgence in the 90s among players in the grunge scene, because you could find one at a pawn shop for dirt cheap, Cyril Nigg, director of analytics at Reverb, told me. Gear revivals are part of the life cycle of music. A soon-to-be famous player comes across forgotten equipment and picks it up because it's cool and inexpensive, and it ends up having a huge influence on their sound and then the culture at large, Nigg said. In one way, though, the VG8's current popularity is slightly newer phenomenon. Vintage gear crazes are usually around analog devices, such as a kind of rebellion against digitization and technology, Steve Waxman, a rock musicologist at the University of Huddersfield, told me. But the VG8's recent rise represents nostalgia for a time when digital was still new. Music sounds so digitized now that even just an earlier digital device feels like it has more character. Roland recently came out with a VG800, a modernized version of the VG8. Marcus Hidalgo, a guitar player in Nashville who performs under the name Toast, told me he'll take it on tour because it's more portable. The newer model, though, is a little too clean, a little too digital. When he saw a VG8 for sale in Facebook Marketplace in Tampa, Florida, he texted his friend in Orlando, "Dude, I will give you all the gas money. I will give you lunch. Whatever you need, if you just drive to Tampa for me and pick up this random old 90s unit from this random guy." He prefers the VG8 and the weird noises it makes. "I feel like I just started to learn how to play the guitar again," he said. Like any tool, the VG8 is only as good as a musician using it, but it holds the promise that there are still new sounds out there to find, even if they're in a device from 1995. And we've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to join us the next time. We hope you've enjoyed listening. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.